NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Twin welfare bills are before the state Senate this week. Both would tighten up the system as it's currently run. The proposal that's received the most attention is known as HB 1658, which gets a hearing before the Senate Finance Committee today. This bill would require more extensive background checks before someone could receive welfare. It was prompted by a welfare fraud review released last month by the NexusLexis company, which lawmakers said showed cheating is more rampant than they thought. The other bill, HB 263, is aimed at how long people can receive welfare benefits, cutting the time from 5 years to three. A Senate vote on this proposal is expected soon. But both bills have sparked vocal and vigorous opposition from anti-poverty groups, cities and towns, even the Department of Health and Human Services. Opponents say these measures are solutions in search of a problem. They say the state already does an excellent job weeding out fraud, that the average length of time on welfare is already much lower than what's allowed in current law, and finally that, taken together, these bills would hurt Granite Staters who are already in pretty dire straits. But supporters of the changes say these lifelines should be limited, encouraging people to get on their own 2 feet. And in a tight fiscal environment, even the smallest amount of fraud is unacceptable. Today in The Exchange, how well does welfare work and could it be improved? Let's hear from you. Should the state conduct more extensive review of applicants to weed out fraud? Are you on welfare or have you ever received benefits? And what are your opinions? Do you think the standards should be tightened up or not? Give us a call. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. We're on Facebook, too. You can post your comments on our page. Our guests are Sarah Mattson, Policy Director of New Hampshire Legal Assistance, a nonprofit law firm offering legal services to senior citizens and low-income residents. And Sarah Mattson, welcome back. Good to see you. Thanks for being here. And Neil Kirk is here, too, Republican representative from Ware, member of the House Finance Committee. He's sponsored the bills that I just mentioned affecting state welfare policy. And Representative Kirk, welcome back and good to see you, too.
Same here, Laura.
Well, and I'll start with you, Representative Kirk, since you are the sponsor of these bills. First of all, just broadly, and then we'll get into the details, why do you think these are needed?
In my role as chairman of the part of finance that deals with health and human services, I constantly over the years have looked at what goes on in this area and have tried to bring things up to date to make the system better, to make the system fairer. There's no particular reason why these particular bills occurred in this session, but over the years, I've noticed that there's been a disparity between New Hampshire and Massachusetts in the amount of time that people can stay on welfare. Massachusetts has a 24-month limit. New Hampshire, at this point, has a 60-month limit, which is the federal maximum.
So 5 years versus 2 years.
Exactly. And so I put in a bill that would change the New Hampshire standard to match Massachusetts. The thinking was there was some anecdotal evidence, but no consistent pattern that some people who were maxing out on welfare in Massachusetts might be coming to New Hampshire and trying to gain another 36 months of assistance. But there's no strong evidence of that, just a few anecdotal cases. The real motivation for this was fairness. We should not be having a system that made New Hampshire more attractive than surrounding states, and particularly Massachusetts, which is the state with which we have the most interconnection in terms of migration between the two states. And so I put the bill in. The bill went to the Commerce Committee, I believe, and they decided, no, it should be 36 months as opposed to 24 months. They also put in a provision that said anyone on welfare was grandfathered. So this only applied to new folks. Right. And I think listeners should know that under federal law, and regardless of whether this bill passes or not, there is a provision that allows up to 20% of the welfare population to be kept on welfare for longer than whatever the state maximum or the federal maximum is.
If it's deemed that they have some severe stubborn problems
exactly. That
are preventing them from.
Exactly. So as a practical matter, I don't think this bill will have any direct impact. The average person is on welfare for about 20 months, which is less than 24 months and less than 36 months. So I think it represents a statement of what policy ought to be. And to me, that ought to be that surrounding states ought to have comparable policies, and one state shouldn't be much more attractive as a place to receive welfare than its surrounding states.
And we'll get into the other bill in a couple minutes, Representative Kirk, the one requiring greater review of applications before someone receives benefits. But just real quick to you, welfare is a broad term. What specific programs are we talking about when we talk about this limit, and what aren't we talking about?
There, in New Hampshire, welfare has, say, five parts to it. If you qualify, you would be entitled to some sort of health care through the Medicaid program. If you qualify, you might be entitled to some sort of housing assistance through the Section 8 program. If you qualify, you might be entitled to some sort of food assistance through the food stamps program, now called SNAP. If you qualify, you might be entitled to child care assistance, tuition at a child care center. In addition to that, we have the traditional welfare program where you receive cash assistance, and that's the one to which the 60-month or the 24-month limitation applies. Regardless of what happens on your cash assistance, eligibility for these other programs would not be changed by this particular program.
Well, and Sarah, so let's talk about this particular program, and then we will get into the one that has to do with tighter review, again, before some can receive benefits. What do you think about this idea, Sarah? 3 years is still more than Massachusetts allows.
Well, interestingly enough, it's really difficult to compare these time limits from state to state. Massachusetts has what's called a periodic time limit, so you can only receive assistance there for 24 months in a 5-month period. But over the course of your lifetime, there's no maximum number of months in terms of the amount of assistance you can receive. Maine and Vermont have no periodic time limit. They have no limit over the course of a person's lifetime. And states also differ in how they count months, which of course is a really important factor. And Massachusetts has a really generous exemption program, meaning there's lots of months when you can be receiving assistance when the month won't count towards your limit. So in my opinion, with the states that border New Hampshire is arguably the least generous. There's no question.
On paper, it looks more generous.
Right. There's no question that Maine and Vermont are more generous in terms of time limits. And because Massachusetts has no lifetime limit but a periodic limit, lots of exemptions, it's tough to compare apples to apples between New Hampshire and Massachusetts.
What about the philosophical idea, though, Sarah, that, you know, there should be limits, that if someone is able to constantly receive TANF, Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, I think is what it's called, that there's no incentive for them to get out and find a job?
Well, one thing that I think is really important to remember is that for people who are able-bodied, the TANF program already has a very rigorous training and work requirement. And people can be sanctioned, in other words, lose a portion or all of their benefits if they don't comply with those requirements. So the people that are more likely to have a longer term stay on TANF are those that have really significant obstacles to self-sufficiency. So people who are disabled, people who are caring for a person who's incapacitated, people who have other really serious obstacles to being able to work. So those are the people that we're concerned about, the people that won't be able to make the transition as readily. And what we think will end up happening is that the Department of Health and Human Services will be reviewing lots of requests for the extensions that Representative Kirk described. So we may end up not saving any money at all, but having to do a lot of additional processing of these extension requests because people will genuinely continue to need the benefit.
Another question that's come up, Representative Kirk, is cities and towns worry that if someone is cut off at the state level, they'll just show up on town hall's doorstep and towns can't turn them away. I wonder how you address this concern of downshifting.
There is the possibility of downshifting, of course, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be to the cities and towns. Downshifting traditionally does mean that, but I'd like to suggest in this case it might be broader because people have other options. There are community organizations, there are religious organizations, there are friends and neighbors who chip in and help out. A number of years ago, I participated in a Walk in Their Shoes program where for a month or so, I and my family lived on a welfare budget, and I met weekly with a group of women in this case who were on welfare and got to understand their thinking and what they were doing. And perhaps this was an atypical group, but this was a group of very resilient people who shared things, who worked together, who found ways to circumvent some of the rules of the system. I think that the downshifting issue that has been raised is more of a red herring and a theoretical possibility than a reality.
New Hampshire Municipal Association doesn't think so. They have been very concerned. They've testified against this.
Absolutely. And theoretically, they're absolutely right. In reality, I don't think this is going to happen, especially with the 20% exception or exemption that,
Sarah Matson, you have quick thoughts from you about downshifting.
I agree. I think it's certainly...
And to whom?
There certainly will be people who, if their TANF assistance is cut off, will end up seeking help from municipalities. The major concern for most of these families will be how are they going to be able to pay their rent? Because if a family doesn't have subsidized housing, the typical TANF grant, which is somewhere in the vicinity of $500, $600, $700, depending on the size of the family, that's basically just enough to cover rent, or not even quite enough to cover rent. So homelessness is certainly the chief concern here. Some families will do what we call double up, which is stay with someone for a while or couch surf. I think that there is absolutely both the theoretical and the very practical possibility that people will be applying for assistance to the town where they live.
Our number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Give us a call. How well do you see our welfare system working here in New Hampshire? Could it be improved? Have you received welfare benefits yourself? If so, tell us about your experience and your own personal thoughts on this issue. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be back in a minute.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, turning investments into loans and education to create opportunity and transform lives. CommunityLoanFund.org. And Upton and Hatfield, representing individuals, municipalities, businesses, and school districts in New Hampshire, with offices in Concord, Hillsborough, Portsmouth, and North Conway. More of New Hampshire's welfare policy under scrutiny on the exchange on NHPR and at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, signs of a slowdown in healthcare spending. New Hampshire weather today, cloudy and cool with showers and drizzle. High temperatures in the 50s. Cloudy showers tonight, lows in the 40s. Tomorrow, cloudy, some showers, a chance of a thunderstorm. High temperatures in the 50s. Saturday, partly to mostly cloudy, some breaks of sunshine and a chance of a shower or thunderstorm. Highs on Saturday in the 60s. Sunny Sunday with highs in the 60s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a look at proposed changes to New Hampshire's welfare policy. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. One bill under debate in the state Senate would reduce the amount of time someone can receive benefits from 5 years to 3. Another would introduce a new verification system for preventing fraud up front. Join us with your thoughts, questions, personal experiences at 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you go to our page and join the conversation there. Well, this conversation about welfare isn't just taking place in New Hampshire. And joining us now for more on that is Rochelle Finzel. She's program manager in the Children and Families Program of the National Conference of State Legislatures. She joins us from Denver, Colorado. And Rochelle, thanks for taking the time for us.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, around the country then, Rochelle, what are you seeing? Is there a movement to tighten up welfare programs in other states or not?
Well, we have seen states that have tightened their programs and reduced services, but we've also seen efforts to ease access to programs as well in response to the recession. So we're really talking about a relatively small number of states. While New Hampshire's not alone in proposing changes, we're not necessarily seeing that it's widespread across all states.
Interesting. So what kinds of changes have we seen, Rochelle? Is it benefits themselves, or who can get them, or how long they can get them? What sorts of themes are you seeing there?
A little bit of both. We have seen a handful of states, around six, that have reduced the amount of cash assistance that families would receive, so reducing that benefit level, as well as limiting the amount of time that families can receive assistance. And again, it's about five states, so we're really not talking about a lot. Others are increasing sanctions for non-compliance with some of the program requirements, as well as some cuts in child care and other employment assistance programs. And then we've definitely seen some interest around drug testing.
You know, here in New Hampshire, there's been a lot of concern about fraud, and we're going to talk more specifically about that in a minute here in the Granite State. But have you seen efforts nationwide, Rochelle, to crack down on fraud? That's a concern.
Yes, most definitely. There have been states that have increased their efforts to identify fraud and improve their efforts at fraud prevention, as well as increasing penalties, and some are even looking at offering rewards for those who report fraud.
Oh, really? Wow. How's that going?
Those are still in process. We haven't seen a lot of actual implementation of those yet.
What do you think is motivating these changes, Rochelle?
I think there are, it's a variety of factors. I mean, definitely the economy and the recession, where there are just so many families that are, you know, without jobs, and the demand for services is up. But and state budgets are really forcing some very hard decisions about program cuts and the use of, you know, taxpayer dollars. But I think there's also a broader concern around the responsiveness of welfare programs as a safety net, and how wide does that safety net need to be, and concerns about whether or not we're going backwards in welfare and not wanting to go back to the pre-welfare reform days when there was a sense of dependency.
I want to ask you about a concern that we often hear expressed about welfare, Rochelle, and that's if one state has more generous benefits than its neighboring state, that state becomes a magnet for those wanting public assistance. Is that true or not? Have you looked at that?
There are some studies on that, and what they have found and what they show is that it's very modest, that if there is going to be that type of what they call welfare-induced migration, that it's when the move is small and the gain is large. So if you're already living on the border and the benefit change is going to be substantially higher, but again, it's still in relatively very small numbers.
How much of a pushback have you seen in these states that have tried to tighten up on welfare, Rochelle? Has there been a lot of pushback, or have most of these changes passed pretty easily?
No, we've definitely seen pushback. I mean, in following these issues across the country, at least the media coverage has done a very good job of pointing out and highlighting some of the work of the state advocacy groups and other policy organizations that have opposed the changes. So I would not say that they've gone through quickly or easily.
Okay. Well, Rochelle, thank you very much for giving us this national picture at Welfare Changes. I appreciate your time.
You're very welcome.
Rochelle Finzel, Program Manager in the Children and Families Program of the National Conference of State Legislatures, again joining us from Denver. Our number for you to join us now is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And before we go to the phone, Sarah Mattson and Neil Kirk, just a quick thought that we got from Rochelle Finzel there. And I think to you first, Sarah. You know, this is obviously driven partly by budgetary concerns. State finances are still very tight, even though the recession has officially been over for some time. But this broad philosophical concern about the safety net, how big it should be, who should be caught up in that safety net, who should not, is that what you see going on here?
Actually, with these two bills, I don't think that either is particularly budget-driven. And I think that particularly House Bill 1658, which I know we're going to talk about later, is driven largely by a myth about who it is that receives assistance from these programs and what they'll do in order to keep receiving assistance. And the reality is that most of these programs that provide cash assistance provide a level of cash that is at or below the level that a person genuinely needs to be able to survive. And the other in-kind benefits, those that provide food assistance or health care, are really helping people to meet their most basic needs. And the programs are very carefully targeted, both in terms of who can qualify, what kind of resources and income they can have before they can qualify. So these programs are helping people who are very, very poor.
Representative Kirk, what do you think? Are we still going back to the mid-90s where we're just concerned about what this safety net should look like? Is that what this is being driven by?
No, I think this is driven by what drives most programs that government provides. You always want to fine-tune them. You want to make sure that there's a fair balance between the beneficiaries of the program and the taxpayers who have to pay for them, that the programs are efficient, that the programs are implemented so that the targeted population is the only one who receives a benefit and not others. As I say, this is – and I agree with Sarah, this is not driven by – neither of these bills is driven by budgetary considerations. They're driven by, I think, a sense of how a system can be run well. You certainly want to include coverage for those people you're targeting, but you certainly want to exclude coverage from people you're not targeting. That's fair to taxpayers and that's fair to beneficiaries. And both of these bills are trying to do that in different ways.
Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. And lots of emails coming in, but let's go to the phones first. Elizabeth's calling from Dover. Hi, Elizabeth. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
My question is, have there ever been any longitudinal studies done on welfare recipients comparing people in systems where there is a strict time limitation on how long they can receive benefits versus in states where the length of time is unlimited? And if the goal with time limited financial assistance programs is to have as many people become contributing members of society, does it work or does it make it harder for them to be successful?
Elizabeth, that's a great question. Both of you, Representative Kirk?
I wish there were studies that could answer all of the questions that we put in legislation for. Frequently, there just aren't any. I'm not aware of any. And if there are, I'd love to see them.
That's the goal, though, right? If you shorten the amount of time someone can receive welfare benefits, the goal and hope is that they will, as Elizabeth says, become a contributing member of society.
There's some of that, yes.
But we don't really know if it works or not.
We do not.
It's a great question, Elizabeth. Sarah?
I agree with Representative Kirk. I'm not aware of any studies. It would be hard, actually, to look at that question. 35 states have the same 60-month time limit that we do. So we're in line with the vast majority of states here. There's not a lot of points for comparison with shorter time limits. And because of what we talked about earlier with how differently different states structure their programs, it's really not easy to compare this particular data point.
Well, we've talked about the time limits, but I do want to turn to the other bill, Representative Kirk, that you have put forward. And this is one that's gotten a lot of press. This is a bill that would require greater review of applications up front to receive benefits. Can you just explain how this would change the current system?
Yes. Currently, the Department of Health and Human Services looks at a variety of databases as well as application information from a person who's seeking welfare or wants to renew his welfare, as well as other programs, including food stamps and so forth. And on the basis of this, they determine that people are eligible. And they do a lot of checking. It's not just looking at databases. It's actually telephoning landlords and things like this to make sure that people are eligible.
So when I apply, if I applied, Representative Kirk, there'd be a lot of phone calling and checking around before I could actually receive that check.
Absolutely. And not all of it is based on the information that you've provided. Some of it is based on databases. We know your name, your date of birth, your Social Security number. The department checks various public and private databases and finds out, are you telling the truth about your assets? Okay. Do you really own your car? Are you really a resident of New Hampshire? The bill, as it was amended by the House Finance Committee and is now in the Senate, tries to improve upon this Basically, it says the department needs to look at additional databases, both public and private, to get additional information. And this was done based on a study that the LexisNexis Corporation did of New Hampshire welfare recipients. It took, I think, 35,000 names and ran them through their databases and came up with what they call hits. That is to say, a person was found, according to one database, to be dead and therefore shouldn't be receiving recipients, or had $400,000 in a home, or a Cadillac, a new Cadillac, and therefore presumably was questionable whether this person was eligible. A hit is not the same thing as determining that the person is ineligible. For example, I understand that somebody checked on the individual who was reputed to be dead. Well, the person wasn't dead. She had been in a nursing home for 20 years. And because there was no activity on her credit card, she didn't vote and so forth, the assumption was she was dead. The purpose of the bill is to make sure that we do our utmost to take scarce taxpayer dollars and allocate them to people who truly need them. We don't want to pay for people who are not eligible for a program, not necessarily because they're committing fraud, but because they just don't qualify and we don't have adequate information under the present system to make that determination. The question that I have about this is whether or not it makes economic sense. In other words,
to use this additional layer.
To use this additional layer. The concept is excellent. But the company that provided the information was unable to answer the department's question about whether or not a certain percentage of these hits resulted in a determination that a person was ineligible. We don't know that. Secondly, the department asked these folks, well, can you give us the results for a certain number of names, a statistical sampling, and let's see what happened in New Hampshire. The company was not willing to do that without charging the department. Then there's the question of, once we have this information, how much time and additional human resources will be necessary to run down all of these and determine that, yes, this person is ineligible and this person is eligible.
Like the lady in the nursing home.
Exactly.
So you end up getting a lot of false positives, so to speak.
Exactly. And what we don't know, and the House Finance Committee did not have time to do based on the legislative schedule, was to investigate that.
Well, this has caused a lot of controversy.
Yes.
And people asking the same questions you're asking, even though you support the legislation still. Is that correct, Representative Kirk?
I support the legislation, but before it comes out of the Senate, I hope, and I'm going to ask the Senate this afternoon, that they will look into whether or not this makes financial sense, whether the cost of doing this will exceed the determination that so many people are not eligible.
Sarah, what do you think? More rigorous checks using the many, many data mining tools that we have available to us today?
Well, first, I think that everyone agrees that the goal of using the scarce state dollars that we have to help the people who are most in need of help is something that I think everyone can agree on. I also agree with Representative Kirk that there are big, big questions that need to be answered about this particular bill before we can determine that it would further that goal in any way. If you read the bill without having any context, you'd think that there isn't any existing process for using databases. There isn't any existing fraud program. In addition to the system of reviewing applications that Representative Kirk described, we also have a three-part fraud program. The state, which I probably shouldn't lump myself in with, but the Department of Health and Human Services, they look at applications in the first instance. They do random audits of food stamps and Medicaid cases and cash assistance cases that are associated with those. They have a special investigation unit that looks at allegations that someone is receiving a benefit inappropriately. That already saves as much as $2 million a year in preventing incorrect payment of benefits. And we simply don't know, number one, how much more fraud will the process set up in House Bill 1658 catch. Will it catch more? Will it catch less? Will it catch the same? And we don't know how much it will cost either. So those are really important questions that I also hope the Senate will answer before deciding to direct the agency to implement this bill.
Well, and I've gotten several emails on this topic, and let me share a couple of them with you. This is from Jay in Dover. As a single homeless person in Dover, I can tell you that applying for assistance through the city of Dover is an ordeal of paperwork, humility, interrogations, questions, and sideways glances as to whether you are already trying to game the system. All in all, simply not worth the hassle. What do you think about that, Representative Kirk? He seems to be saying it's already pretty tough to get these benefits.
He's talking about going to local welfare,
right,
as opposed to state welfare, and this bill deals with the state welfare system. One of the things that I tend to believe is that folks at the local welfare office are very knowledgeable people. They have firsthand and secondhand information about the folks there, and they're also pretty savvy. I know that a number of years ago in my hometown of Ware, people who applied for and received welfare were also told that there were some community service that they had to perform as a condition of receiving this, and the towns are allowed to do that. And that had a very salutary effect of distinguishing between those people who truly were in need and those people who perhaps were gaming the system. So I'm sorry this individual had that experience, but my guess is that the Dover folks are doing just what they ought to be to balance the taxpayer Dover taxpayer dollars against the need to provide assistance to truly needy people.
Here's an email from Arnie in Concord who says, Representative Kirk has a reputation as a fierce defender of privacy. Is he concerned that privacy could be compromised by allowing a company like LexisNexis to have so much data about New Hampshire residents?
Not at all. When a person applies for public assistance or indeed almost any federal program, you give up a great deal of your privacy in order to apply. You have to provide information, financial information and personal information. This company would have access to some of that information, but for very limited purposes, and would not go into some national data bank that they could then use for unrelated purposes. So I don't see that this is an additional privacy issue.
So when you apply for public benefits, you need to expect some measure of lack of privacy, to put it that way?
Absolutely. You have to tell them about your financial assets. You have to give them bank account numbers. You have to tell them where you live. You have to give your social security number and date of birth and goodness knows what else. So I don't think that's a real issue in this particular case.
We'll take more of your emails after a short break. And, sir, I've got another question for you as well. Our number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
Today on Word of Mouth, a special broadcast of our conversation with Talk of the Nation Science Friday's Ira Flatow. He shares the reason why he's so alarmed about the state of science coverage in the news.
Do you know what the news budget of NBC News is? They can't figure out how they know that. My fear is that they don't want to figure it out.
I'm Brady Carlson. Tune in for a special broadcast of Word of Mouth with Ira Flatow today at noon and 9 p.m. on NHPR.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Jaguar Exeter, serving New Hampshire and Vermont, featuring the redesigned 2012 Jaguar XF, an innovative blend of design and technology, online at jaguarexeter.com. An Apple Wild School in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, an independent K-8 school on 26 acres, serving southern New Hampshire and central Massachusetts, applewild.org. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, our series on New Hampshire's immigration story continues with how illegal immigration shapes this debate. Email us your thoughts before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today, the Granite State debate over welfare policy. We're looking at two bills, one that would limit the amount of time people can receive public assistance from 5 years to 3. Another one would require more extensive background checks, a new verification system up front for preventing welfare fraud. Give us your thoughts. Do you think our welfare system could be improved through these measures? Should the state conduct more extensive review of applicants? Have you received welfare benefits yourself? If so, what are your thoughts on this issue? Our number 1-800-892-6477. And Sarah Mattson, Representative Kirk, let's go to the phones again. And Marie is waiting in Concord. Hi, Marie. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I am a very educated woman. And years ago, I ended up having to go on welfare. We had a business. My husband lost a business. I lost a professional job. And we had four children.
Wow.
And because I was married, we were actually forced to have to separate because we couldn't have benefits being married, even though we had been together like 18 years. And so for a country that believes in trying to keep families together, it didn't do a good job on that stance. And because I was professional, I could work part-time but make some fairly good money. And what I found frustrating was that the little bit of money I could make, let's say $400 a month, I think, at the time, or $600 a month, was not enough for me to be financially independent and take care of the children. But if I made that much money, it put me over so that I did not qualify for food stamps or very little food stamps. We lost medical benefits. So the choice I had to make, because there was no scaffolding to help support me to be independent, was to either not work and make little enough money to stay on welfare, or if I could have made a $30,000 a year job, be independent.
So what's the solution, Marie, given your situation where you were making not enough to survive but too much to receive benefits?
The solution would have been to have some kind of steps that said, okay, you're making this much money, you're trying to work. Instead of slapping your hand for trying to be independent, we will continue to give you some food stamps, and we'll continue to help you with some rental support, and we will continue to at least give medical benefits to the children till you have worked at least long enough to be able to get medical benefits through work. And since I was working part-time, that wasn't enough.
You don't get those benefits. Marie, thanks for calling. Interesting to hear from you, given your experience. What do you think, Sarah, of her story?
Well, first of all, it is the case that most of these benefits programs change the amount of assistance depending on the income and resources that are available to the family. So if you're eligible to receive TANF, but you have a part-time job that brings in a little bit of money, you'll have a lower TANF benefit. But Marie is absolutely right that there are many, many families and single people in New Hampshire who are struggling mightily and are not eligible for these programs. They are, without question, designed to help people who are very, very poor. And there are plenty of people who I think most people would agree don't have enough to really get by and still aren't eligible. And that is a problem that's only gotten worse as people have lost jobs, as people have had their hours reduced. And it results in people having to make really difficult decisions between paying the rent and paying for medical bills and choosing to have substandard child care rather than the child care that they would prefer. So she's absolutely right.
Wasn't the welfare reform under President Clinton back in the mid-90s, and I know I'm going back here, but mm-hmm. I remember this conversation, and I thought that we fixed that there wasn't this sort of all-or-nothing world that Marie found herself in.
For some programs, there's not. But for some programs, you do hit sort of a hard income ceiling, at which point you no longer qualify. And what Marie identified that I think is one of the biggest holes is there's very little cash assistance available, if any, to a two-parent family with children. We only had until the last state budget, we had one cash assistance program for families with children in which there's not a disabled person. That was called the Unemployed Parent Program, and you could receive TANF assistance if the primary breadwinner lost a job. That program, unfortunately, was cut in the last state budget. And so at this point, for two-parent families, there's no cash assistance left in our family assistance program.
What do you think, Representative Kirk? A couple points that Marie raises. Go ahead.
I have a great deal of sympathy for her in that situation, but when it comes to welfare and state benefits, and not just in this program, we're always balancing the need of the individual involved and the willingness and the ability of the taxpayers to pay for that. There are a lot of people in our society who can use assistance. But not everybody is going to get it because it comes out of somebody else's pocket. And one of our tough jobs, especially in this last budget, was to balance the voters' decision in 2010 that government had grown too large and spending was out of control with the needs of people. And we made some very serious reductions in the state budget because the group of elected officials came in on that wave of no big government, excessive spending. And the balance has been redressed. It may be that the next group of elected officials reflect a change in the public opinion. So I don't know what happened 15 or 20 years ago when the caller's case was before the legislature. But this balance is constant. It's being redressed and looked at continuously. And I don't think it will ever be resolved. We are never going to get to a situation where the state provides everything for everyone.
Here's an email from Keith who says, could your guests explain the department's current fraud prevention program? Could your guests speak to the possible delay that may occur to people eligible for benefits because of HB 1658? Again, this is the tougher verification up front that we talked about. And Keith asks, could those delays cause New Hampshire to be in violation of any federal time limits? And what possible impact on the needy could we see from such delays? Both of you, I think you, Representative Kirk, first, the idea that if we did institute this tougher verification process, people might get delays in getting the benefits that they need. That seems to be Keith's question.
It's a possibility, and I don't know. And that's one of the things that I think needs to be looked at. We certainly don't want to increase the time that it takes to receive benefits for those who are entitled to them. On the other hand, we don't want to provide benefits to those who are not. A small delay probably is acceptable. A large delay might run into some of the problems that Keith is talking about. But at this point, the question needs to be answered, but we don't have the answer.
Have other states done this? Do either of you know? Done this more sort of private company data mining that we're looking at here? Has anyone else done this, Sarah? Do you know?
It's been said that the state of Pennsylvania has done a similar trial program to what we're looking at here in New Hampshire. I don't think that any state has gone wholly to a system like the one that is proposed by House Bill 1658 at this point, which is because federal law already requires looking at a wide array of databases. So all states are already doing this as a condition of being able to get federal help with their programs.
But the real issue is this. Most of us, and I'm speaking about the general public, not the beneficiaries of this system, most of us really have a great deal of compassion and want to help those people truly in need. But we really have a problem when somebody puts one over on us, the welfare queens, you know, that kind of concept. And how do we get a balance between making sure those who need get and those who shouldn't don't? And that's where we're trying to take another step. Can we do something that'll make the taxpayer say, yes, this system really is working. The benefits are going to those who I feel need it, and I'm willing to pay my taxes to support it.
Well, that's a question for you, Sarah. You know, even if this effort helped weed out, you know, three or four or five cases of fraud, could it bring more integrity to the program? And in the end, as Representative Kirk says, bolster public support for welfare?
Well, I think the question is to what degree it will actually do that. We've talked about how that's an unanswered question. The other concern is that the cost of doing this, which is not just the cost of paying a private company to run these databases, but also the cost of additional staff at the Department of Health and Human Services to review new information that may not be helpful to them in any way. If that costs a lot of money, and I think that there's a very good chance that it will, where is that money going to come from? It's likely that it is going to come from the same pot of money that is funding these programs in the first place. So it presents the question to find those three or four extra cases of fraud. How much is everyone else, and the vast majority of these recipients will never even produce a hit in the database, much less actually be found to have committed fraud? How many of them will have their benefits reduced or delayed as a result? So it absolutely is a question of how we want to balance these competing goals. And what I feel sure about is that this bill does not strike that balance.
That's the bang for the buck question that you yourself raised, Representative.
Right. There are about 9,000 people now who are receiving these kinds of benefits. I'm not sure it's going to be five or six. What happens if it's hundreds? We don't know. And at the moment, we need to get the answers to that before we go forward with this.
I've got another question for you, and it's a little set aside from the two bills we've been looking at. We, as you know, have been looking all year at New Hampshire's own immigration story, the history, the current issues, and so forth. Can both of you just clarify for us how immigrants and refugees, especially low-income immigrants, because many immigrants are, you know, high professionals. In fact, data has shown that many of New Hampshire's immigrants are working in high tech and healthcare and so forth. But low-income immigrants, refugees, Sarah, to you first, how do they fit into the welfare program in terms of what benefits they are eligible for?
There's not a simple answer to that question, and most of that is governed by federal law. Generally speaking, people who are legal immigrants, so those that are here with a green card generally, have to wait 5 years before they can be eligible for assistance. People who are undocumented are completely ineligible. You can essentially get emergency medical care at a hospital
if
you're undocumented. You can't get food stamps. You can't get healthy kids gold for your children. So it's actually people who are refugees do qualify. So people who come in through the refugee settlement resettlement program are able to qualify for some of these benefits. But for most legal immigrants, you're looking at a five-year wait.
And refugees are a different category. They're brought in here under State Department
right.
auspices. They get a little money to start out, but as we've learned, it's not very much. So once that federal subsidy runs out, some of them have to go on welfare.
Actually, a lot of refugee families were in the unemployed parent program that we described. They were often benefiting from that program because of having lost a job. So they're in the same position that any other family is in terms of if there's a two-parent family, they wouldn't be eligible for a cash assistance program.
Has this come up at all, Representative Kirk, in your conversations about welfare policy reform?
No.
Nothing about immigrants and refugees and what impact they may be having on the system?
Not at all.
Okay.
Except tangentially, when it comes to a bill that's before the legislature to allow a community to have a moratorium on accepting refugees, and that bill is still in the legislative process. But the issue was raised by Manchester in terms of having to absorb a large number of refugees who were requesting welfare assistance after their federal assistance had come out. But that did not have anything to do with the state's program.
I see. Again, that's city and
program.
Town.
It's city and
okay.
town.
Right? All right. Let's take one more call if we could. And Erica's waiting in Lebanon. Hi, Erica. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. It's been a great discussion so far. I have a comment that I would like to hear some response to, and that's Representative Kirk has mentioned, you know, needing to balance the needs of meeting the needs of those in our state who are struggling to get by, and balancing that with the needs of taxpayers. And I feel like one piece that's been missing from that balance equation is what about the longer term needs of our state overall. And so in particular, you know, research tells us that children living in poverty is the leading factor that will hobble a child's development and keep them from reaching their full potential. So in terms of the overall needs of the state, you know, is it good when a family has to choose substandard child care, you know, and what does that mean for, do we have kids, you know, entering school ready to learn, graduating from high school, and becoming good potential people for our workforce?
So
where does that longer-term need come in?
So you're saying there's a third piece that we haven't looked at yet, the longer-term impacts of poverty on our population.
Correct.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling in, Erica. What do you think, Representative Kirk?
I'm reminded of the argument that we get from various groups who are coming before the legislature and want some assistance. And they explain, whether it's a tourist group or an industry group, that for every dollar the state spends, there will be $7 of savings. In this case, I'm sure The caller would say we'll avoid a great deal of expense on prison populations, we'll reduce welfare expenses in the future. If you accept that argument, and there is some truth to it, but if you accept that argument fully, the role of the state in society would dramatically increase. The cost to the taxpayers in the short run would go up. And one time I did this, I totaled up all the savings that were going on. If we spent this much money and we would save that much money, it exceeded the state gross domestic product. In other words, there's a lot of double counting going on when people are saying, invest this, you get this much back later. At the end of the day, we try to look at the long term. We, like most people, tend to recognize that we live in the short term. We consider this, we make a balance, and that's where we are today.
So that's the argument that you hear vis-a-vis many programs. Invest this much and you'll get this much payback.
Right.
What do you think about her point, Sarah?
Well, I think that it is hard to quantify the impact of some of these problems. Things like homelessness, food insecurity, lack of access to health care. These are problems that have very real consequences for people. It is difficult to say what future costs you can prevent, but I think there's no question that you are saving money over the long term when you make sure that people are able to meet their most basic human needs.
Well, I want to thank both of you being here. This has been real interesting. Sarah Mattson, thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Sarah Mattson, Policy Director of New Hampshire Legal Assistance. Representative Kirk, good to have you. Thank you also.
Thank you, Laura.
Neil Kirk, Republican representative from Ware, member of the House Finance Committee. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our interns are Ryan Lassard and Tim Camerato. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Become a fan of our Facebook page where you can learn more about upcoming shows and get extra links and material.